Hey, what's up, Kamisato Podcast fans, young and old, all across the nation and across the world. If it is your first time listening to the Kamisato Podcast, we thank you for tuning in. If it is your second, third, fourth, if you're a longtime listener, we appreciate you for constantly coming back and checking out the content that we have. So this podcast episode is a What's Up Wednesday, and as always with the What's Up Wednesdays, I have my illustrious co-host, my homie
Lucius Illuminix,
and our What's Up Wednesday guest today is Ann Bean of Emerald Comics Distribution, friend of the show. You all may have heard us talk about her very highly in a couple of the episodes when we spoke with Jerome Walford of Ford Comics, and you all probably remember the first time we spoke to her when she was giving us the details on her comics distribution line. So, Anne, just tell the listeners a friendly hello.
Hello. Glad to be back.
Yes, we're happy to have you back. And here's what we're going to be getting into. So it's been about 6 months since Emerald Comics Distribution has been live, correct?
Correct. When I spoke to you last in June, I think I'd had books and shops for a little over a month. At this point, it's been a little over 6 months. So that's kind of a nice milestone to check in at.
Woohoo!
Woo!
Yeah, so we're going to check in, chat Emerald Comics and a bunch of other awesome nerd comic book industry stuff. And we hope that you listeners enjoy this and it gives you a little background on the distribution side of the comic book industry. So that's what we're going to get into tonight. So, as usual, I turn it over to my co-host, Lou, and he gets us rolling with our opening question. So, there you go, buddy.
Okay, so first thing that's coming to my mind is I'm wondering, as you sort of settle into an environment, you start to pick up on more details and start to notice more things and things that work, things that don't, what your unique voice is. Oh, similar, we did that as a podcast, so I'm wondering what your six-month-in eyes see that your eyes didn't see when you were a month into sales?
Yeah, that's a great question. Part of it is I have a little bit more of a sense of what kind of a catalog I'm building. I started out doing a big scattershot of open submissions and doing a little bit of mostly local asking, soliciting people, seeing if they were interested in getting my services. And I kept submissions open for about 4 months and then shut them down for a couple of months, partially so I could focus a little more time on expanding the number of stores that I was working with, but partially so that I could spend some time kind of wandering around the internet, seeing what was out there. And I did not do as good of a job as I would have liked in terms of select people during that time. But I'm also kind of aware of the critical mass of how big I can grow my 20 shot I work with. only so much. Then I need to get more shops. I need to get a more customers in order to make it worth the time to have X number of people in my catalog. But my catalog in general is taking shape. It started out in June. I had about 35 items. Nope, that's just the trade paperbacks. Just kidding. In June, I had about 65 items, and now I have about 120.
Yeah, so almost doubling.
Yeah. So
that's awesome.
And the submissions keep coming. For a while, you know, I didn't do the best job of really updating my submissions my website in a super timely fashion when I was ready to start taking submissions again. It was a couple of weeks late after the date it said on the top of my website. And a lot of that did not stop people from submitting. They're like, it said the 15th on your website, so I'm guessing, here you go. Okay. People are definitely very hungry for the service, and I feel like I'm picking up some nifty stuff that kind of, you know, bits of it hold together coherently. I still do have stuff that's all across the board, from all ages titles to porn to big anthologies to all kinds of things. I have a pretty strong representation for all ages comics. I have a pretty strong representation for, and I'm getting some really interesting anthologies. Jerome's Guan anthology from Forward Comics being one of them. And some things that are also web comics, but have nice printed versions.
Okay.
But I hope to work with more presses and more of the, you know, really fascinating Kickstarter anthologies that are coming down the pipeline. I just signed paperwork for an anthology called Power and Magic. The editor is based out of Portland, but it is a anthology of queer witch comics entirely done by women and non-binary people of color. And it's pretty freaking rad. I realize that's also pretty niche, but it's a beautiful book. And turns out Pacific Northwest likes its occult stuff. So there we go. It's been funny what's been good sellers. Books with cats. That has, okay. Yep. Cat books, definitely those sell. strongly themed anthologies sell pretty well. For sheer numbers, one of my best sellers has been an anthology called Grab Back Comics, which is comic stories about sexual assault, rape culture, and advocacy. It's a wide variety of stories. It's interesting. It, you know, it has a lot of emotion in it, but it is not... I feel empowered after reading it, as opposed to like depressed and determined to never leave my house again.
Okay.
When you have shops that sell your books, do you look for certain things in shops? Like maybe you wouldn't put it in a shop that doesn't do a lot of indie books, or sticks them in a back corner somewhere?
There is a... probably about a quarter of my catalog that is pretty friendly to shops that don't have indie comics or that have a limited section of indie comics. Some of my all ages titles, a lot of the big nicely produced trades are that, especially if they have, you know, they've got a barcode, they've got a cover price, they're professionally produced. Those I will talk to the shop owner and see what kinds of books they sell, and then show them a, you know, limited selection of my trades that I think would do well there. Maybe a couple of the issues if I feel like the content fits with a lot of what they sell. And there, I do have a couple of shops that are like that. They don't really have an indie section. And I would say for those shops, all ages comics tend to be the ones that they'll buy more of. That doesn't mean they won't buy other things, but occasionally, like one shop that I sell to up in Mill Creek, Magic Mirror Comics, it doesn't have a particularly big indie section, but it does have a robust all ages section, and it also has an LGBTQ section. So some of the anthologies or other books that aren't necessarily a glossy trade paperback have found a good home over there.
So, and you had you said that one book that's been doing very well with sheer numbers is the anthology. You said Grab. What was that one?
Grab Back Comics.
Grab Back. Okay.
Its subtitle is Acts of Love and Resistance.
Okay.
And there's a website associated with it that has a lot of the stories on there at grabbackcomics.com.
Okay, cool. And do you think it's, I guess, just the current social climate of sexual assault awareness advocacy movements to create spaces that, you know, that will actually address this issue in our day and age? Do you think that's kind of what's propelling it, or are the stories just really good?
It's a combination of two things. One, just like we're in a very potent time for telling stories about sexual assault. Two, it's an attractive book, I think that okay. I really genuinely think that helps. And it is marketable both to bookstores and to comic shops. In a bookstore, it's going to I hate to make fun of the University of Washington bookstore, except that I don't, because I think the way that they shelve their comics is weird, because they have like it's less weird than it used to be. It used to be anime and superhero upstairs, and downstairs was arty comics. They still have their arty comics section, but upstairs I think it's just like it's next to the science fiction section. It's just comics. Okay. So I just find it funny thinking about like, okay, how arty is a comic before it's an arty comic?
That's what I was about to ask.
Walking Dead downstairs, and I'm like, how is that arty? I get that you've got all your Drawn and Quarterly stuff downstairs. Okay, but anyway, Grab Back is an arty comic in terms of it's not entirely black and white. There's some color in it, but it's, you know, autobiographical, and there's a lot of very like variety of artistic style, and the cover is like, again, this like beautiful bright pink and teal risograph thing that has a picture of a dog grabbing a bone in its mouth. It's a well-designed cover. It's a striking book. It's got nice, especially for the Northwest, it's got what do you call the quote that you put on the book? I can't even think of that. The quote that you put on the book from like pretty decently big names for the Northwest. Paul Constant, that does the Seattle Review of Books, Ellen Forney, who did the graphic novel Marbles. So yeah. Like,
oh man, I can't think of the name either. I know what you mean.
Right.
The accolades or the whatever. What is it, Lou?
They'll pop up randomly, I'm sure.
Yeah, we'll think of it in 20 minutes. Go, wait, it's this. So, and it's bucking my trend in terms of like this particular book doesn't have a barcode on it. It does have a cover price on it because I told my client that she should put a cover price on it. So she has little stickers that like nicely match it that have a cover price on there. But I think... For sheer numbers, the best sales come from comics that are in both bookstores and comic shops. I wish I had better data, and I will talk to shop owners after the holiday season in particular, because I'm curious like how many of them get a big holiday rush and how many of them don't. For indie comics, like here's a very specific regional issue, after the short run festival in Seattle, all the local comic shops are like filled with indie comics and don't want to like I'm doing restocks this December, but they're like, I don't want to look at anything else. There's too much. My shelves are full. Which makes sense, because Short Run is a reasonably sized they probably have 100 tables or so, fun indie con that happens in November. And a lot of folks are like, well, I'm in town for this, so I may as well do my big, or I just released a new mini comic for this con, so I want to bring it around after that.
Oh, Short Run sounds like a really fun experience.
It is. It's great. It was packed this year and had some pretty good programming that went along with it. It's always I've been going to it for years, and it's in a space that's about twice as big as what it used to be, and it's still packed. It's a good time.
I probably should have went to that.
Come sometime. Right. It is only a 1-day con, which makes it a little tougher to travel to, but you know, Bellingham is not too far, and it's always the same weekend as Jet City, which is a show in Tacoma, and it's a very like, I want to say old school show, in terms of there's actually a lot of folks that are there to like collect rare back issues type of thing. I did end up going down and checking out Jet City on the Sunday of that weekend, because I was giving a talk with Michael Fitzgerald, who owns Destiny City Comics in Tacoma. We were giving a talk about how to get your books into stores. Ta-da. And it was interesting. It was interesting to see that con in particular. It's definitely kind of a smaller, sleepier, it was more, I guess, yeah, old school type of a con. It wasn't particularly huge. It wasn't as big as Rose City or anything. Interesting to see nonetheless.
So do you, or yeah, do you plan on doing more cons? Did you do any more cons, whether talking or a table or something like that?
Yes, I am excited that I was accepted into DINC, which is Denver something, something, something. I'm going to look it up right now. Denver Independent Comics and Art Expo, which I am from the greater Denver area originally. That will be fun to go back. And that's in mid-April. And I'll be at Emerald City Comic Con. I'm on the waiting list for a table, and I am assuming by December that means I'm not getting one. That's one I'll probably have to be persistent with. Although apparently they have kind of a new home, I think they're calling it homegrown or something section, which is for, it's in the exhibitor section, but it's for local folks. So that's kind of exciting to hear about. I'll be interested to see what it's like this year. I feel like last year it took one step to being a little bit more like New York Comic Con. And I say that because at Emerald City, there used to be kind of a weird, like Artist Alley was split into two places. And it felt kind of gross because it felt like there was like the cool higher traffic Artist Alley and the less cool Artist Alley. And they put everything on a whole different floor from like anything else in the con, but all together. And with the podcasters. And that seemed to work out pretty well last year anyway. So I'm excited to see what it's like again this year. My partner has a Artist Alley booth because he is an illustrator and a painter. And he's been tabling at Emerald City for many years. So, I mean, I have a home base, which will be nice. And I'll probably spend Emerald City doing a lot of networking and possibly being on a panel if I hear back from the person who's organizing it, if this panel is accepted, sort of about like where the future of comics distribution in general is going. I hope that panel gets accepted because I think it would be pretty interesting and timely to talk about it.
So question that I had with that, when it comes to the future of comics distribution, Lou and I, on many occasions, we've talked about the is it descent, or maybe even like maybe there might be like a recession when it comes to floppies because of just storage issues for like fans collecting it. So we've always imagined this instance where a lot of things may be digital on single issues, and then people may start to collect more trade paperbacks. So I guess I'm wondering, As more and more people do go to the digital route for their comic book storage and stuff, how will that influence just hard paper tactile distribution practices?
I think I honestly kind of hope that one thing it does is push more the trade paperbacks and hardbacks into traditional book distribution. Like, I hope that there comes a tipping point where at some point it's worth it for your average comic shop to get an account with Ingram or an account with Baker mm-hmm. and Taylor and order books from that. I know Iron Circus Comics is pushing the Ingram, Baker, and Taylor route because they get distribution through Consortium, and Consortium feeds into the, like, all kinds of book distribution. And is a pretty easy, like, every bookstore has an account with them. Every library can order from them. So hopefully more comics will get pushed into mainstream book distribution. I definitely hear you about the floppy kind of having a little bit of a flop, as it were. and yeah, storage is an issue. And yeah, it's, I see a lot of people waiting on trades and not being, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know if it's more casual comics readers or if it's more comics readers that are just tired of, you know, having a bunch of short boxes kicking around their house or some combination, or like you said, digital availability. But I don't think it's necessarily a terrible thing that the floppy is getting less popular. I think what will continue to be popular, although not necessarily like soup, there's not going to be money in this, is the sort of art object type of zine-like floppy. Okay. So like people who are doing cool stuff with printing or interesting stuff with color or are releasing stuff and, you know, this sort of stuff that you pick up at the Indie Comic Con in terms of the direct market, none of that stuff is going to make it onto the direct market anyway. Okay. In the first place. So I think that right. stuff will continue to have its place. I don't know. I'm thinking of like some stuff that I collect, like Sex Criminals, and it's had a kind of wildly varied schedule in terms of when it actually comes out. Like there's some times when, you know, it drops a issue a month like clockwork, and then it's had big breaks and here and there. And that's common for a lot of stories, especially ones that are creator owned or out of the big two, even if they're still, you know, Image or, you know, Dark Horse or whatnot. So right.
Sex Criminals is with Fraction and Kelly Sudaconic, right?
It's Matt Fraction writes it and then Chip Zdarsky draws it.
Yeah, I know Fraction is not a blast against Fraction, but I know he does a lot of really cool and crazy stuff.
He does.
And then that cool and crazy stuff generally throws his schedule off because he wrote Hawkeye.
Yeah.
Which was the first Hawkeye. Yeah, I loved it. But I think at like issue 16 or 17, I started to realize, oh, dang, it's like the 2 month, 3 month delay for like issue 18.
Yeah. And then,
so yeah, I was like, oh, Matt's like a.
I feel like if you like ever talk to Matt Fraction, you just understand instantly.
Yeah, yeah.
He's like the type of dude, like you talk and you're like,
I get why.
I get it all.
I completely understand now. You just be great writing your awesome stories. I'm not even going to be mad at you. I'm going to just grab this trade when the trade happens.
Yeah, I'm still waiting on the second volume of Odyssey.
Oh, yeah.
I might be waiting years on that.
Well, I don't know. I've seen stuff take a while to get a second trade, but then get a second trade. I have hope for Odyssey. It's probably overly optimistic hope, but it's been interesting seeing for my clients who's on some kind of a release schedule and who's not. Mm-hmm. I have picked up and honestly dropped a couple of titles that got a number one and then number two may or may not ever happen, and maybe we were waiting for magically awesome sales of number one before doing number two and mm-hmm. that didn't happen. But some folks are on a pretty dedicated schedule, honestly, and a lot of people finish work for whatever con or cons they're tabling, like use that as a deadline for themselves. That works out pretty well.
I have sort of PTSD of a bunch of indie number ones or volume ones that never never saw an issue two or a volume two. So I get super weary and picking stuff up sometimes.
I get it. I am a lot more careful than I was at the very beginning about asking people who are releasing a number one or a number two where their project is going and, you know, how much of it they have done and what their plan is for releasing it. And, you know, I get that, yeah, sometimes you got to wait to get printing money before you can do anything with it. But a lot of the folks I'm working with are pretty smart about how many resources they're sinking in per print run so that they don't, you know, print 1,000 copies of issue one and then be broke. And some of the stuff that I carry is like a print volume of web comics. So it's something where there's maybe two or even three times the material of what's printed online. And the people who are buying the physical copies are a combination of people who are curious about the comic and people who very well know the comic and want to pick up a physical copy of it.
Sweet. So question on, I guess, two-part question. Hopefully we get to both of them. First part, as a distributor, how, and I know you said that you're a bit weary of asking them their project trajectory, basically. So I guess, like, how do you massage or finesse that conversation to make sure that you're taking care of your bottom line also while, you know?
Oh, I wouldn't say I'm particularly wary about it. I usually ask them what their release schedule looks like or, okay. You know, is this a, what do you see the story arc as here? Like, how many things are you planning on making? I'll give you an example of someone who's doing a very good job with this. I went down to Portland and visited with a creator, Matthew Bogart, who has this beautiful little, it's about quarter sheet size book called Incredible Doom. And I knew that he would be a good pick for my catalog, partially because his art is really good and the object itself is really beautiful, but partially because he has a whole plan. He's making 5 of these and then they're going to go in a little cardboard slip cover, kind of like those sets of kids books that you get that are in like small books in a slip cover.
Yeah. And I'm like, oh yeah, yeah.
That's really cool. A and B, it's, you know, he's posting them online. I think he has almost 3 issues up online. And one issue, you know, issue 1 is printed. I've been distributing it for a few months. And then issue 2 is going to be printed within the next month or so. So he has a plan. He has a project with a beginning and an end. That's not to say that I'll never take projects that don't have a beginning and an end. But the more that I have been experimenting with that, the more I've found that projects that have some sense of a story arc work really well. I mean, even... another one of my creators, Laura Graves, who writes really rad, hilarious comics in this like bizarro demon universe that's informed a little bit by Japanese and a little bit by Russian culture. I don't know. It's cool. They're demons. I know that she is not like just, she's also a friend and I have seen her working on this project for like years. And she definitely isn't the sort of person who sits down and like architects out exactly what she's doing for, you know, the next years. But at the same time, everything that she's released has a story arc to it. And stands pretty well on its own. She has all of her comics up on the web, but like you could pick up any one of her books and feel satisfied with what you have in your hands, whether or not you go find the rest of the story, which is nice.
Oh, that's dope. That's cool then. Yeah. And so my second question was, when it comes to the web comics that you are distributing, I guess, how does... I'm trying to think, how does the story arc format work with them? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I would say most of the creators who are releasing trades of their webcomic have chosen pretty good cutoffs in terms of it's one big story arc and they're releasing these a trade at a time. They're not trying to do issues or anything because what's the point? So... all the ones that I have are either fully completed, like Shane and Garrity's comic Narbonic, which is sort of a classic comic of the classic web comic of the early 2000s. It ran from 2002 to 2006, and I totally used to read it in like when it was live, and that was kind of cool to start carrying her stuff. I carry a comic called Midwinter, which is on Topastic. It's ongoing right now. It's beautiful science fantasy sort of it's one part espionage, one part abjuration or conjuration or some cool thing that involves making big mandalas in the air. Anyway, it's cool. It's sort of like General Hospital meets like Dungeons and Dragons. And that's ongoing. That's Intapastic. That's a creative team out of Omaha, Nebraska, that are definitely formatting their trade to trim size and everything match the anime standard or manga standard, pardon me. So I wouldn't be surprised to find this book in like your Barnes and Noble manga section that some of us may have spent a bunch of time in as a teenager, you know. It's
word.
Yeah, I think that webcomics people, honestly, generally by the time that they're releasing trade paperbacks, they know pretty well what they're doing. I don't think that's necessarily universal, but certainly the folks that I have dealt with have a pretty solid idea of, you know, how much content to release in a given volume, and they already have a built-in audience, which can be super useful for, you know, book sales. And quite a few of them are funding their print runs off of Kickstarter. So on the one hand, that makes distribution immediately not super necessary. But on the other hand, it's useful to have distribution for that sort of product further down the road, especially for shops. Because a lot of the way that folks who are doing Kickstarters will format retailer packages is, you know, X number of wholesale priced copies to a retailer. And usually that number doesn't go too much more than 5 at a time. And usually if it's like someone kind of like what Forward Comics was doing, I can't remember what their exact reward was, but I've seen small presses fund a whole season of content at a time, which sometimes works, sometimes does not. But I've seen retailer packages in terms of that be like, get 5 of everything. One thing that I tried out with Comiker Press, and unfortunately it didn't work because their Kickstarter didn't fund, but something that I'm going to be pushing going forward is letting Emerald function as a more flexible pre-order system for shops. So that, for example, if you wanted an option other than 5 of everything, you could do that. And like you as a retailer could put in a more flexible order, and then right. I as distributor can do a pledge that represents all of the pre-orders I've gotten.
Wow, that's pretty awesome. I didn't even
yeah.
smart.
Wow. That's real smart.
So aside from the fact that the Kickstarters that I was trying that with haven't gone through, I am getting that system somewhat in place with the retailers, and they're definitely into having more options when it comes to ordering Kickstarter books, because they do. A lot of times when I see some cool indie title on the shelf, I'm like, where did you get that? And they're like, from the Kickstarter.
Wow, that's pretty dope.
I hope it takes off.
Yeah. Well, I mean, me too. That just see it's because I'm not very familiar with Kickstarter. I haven't funded a lot of campaigns, and I always wondered how they got, I would say, like wholesale or like mass stuff, you know, after the Kickstarter campaign was completed. So, whoa, that's really cool.
Yeah, I don't know that there is a particularly great portal for wholesaling after a Kickstarter. There's some great fulfillment portals in terms of getting your rewards done. There's some awesome like secondary businesses around that, but I don't think there's a whole lot in terms of connecting up comic shops with Kickstarter reordering, for example.
Right.
So as you've gone on with your submissions, have you gotten more selective too, like things that didn't impress you or things that passed early on might not necessarily impress now?
Yes, partially because I have a much better sense of what is going to, like, bottom line, what's going to sell and what's not. Mm-hmm. And again, I realize I have a tiny audience that I am trying to sell stuff to. Like, basically, it's the 20 or so, you know, 20 to 30 employees that I interact with from these mm-hmm. 20 or so shops, which again, it's a small pool right now. Hoping to do some major steps to make that pool a little bigger. And I keep getting shops that are like, hey, I want to order your comics. So I'm like, cool. I want you to order my comics. Let's figure out how. And and they haven't actually seen my catalog. It's like, so some shops that contact me are just like, you seem cool. Let's talk. So, you know, once I get the infrastructure in place for example, mail orders, I'm definitely gonna have more people to. Anyway, that was a tangent. My point was that I have like 20 people that I'm trying to convince that they should buy my comics. So, for example, a comic I recently picked up, which is a collection of a webcomic that's done in kind of newspaper strip format called Chuck the Monk, is this book that it is. Like the main, it's anthropomorphic cats, cute little cartoon cats. They are little Buddhist monks. And it's like kind of newspaper comics-y, witty observations with a lot of humor about both Buddhism and cats. I met the creator, who is a Buddhist monk who was in Seattle for a little while and then was like taking his van up to Alaska and it was just sort of doing a lot of traveling and had his stock on the East Coast and mailed me individually wrapped books because that's how they were packaged in his warehouse. Anyway, interesting person. The point is, I'm like, wow, Buddhist cat comics. One of my shop people that I sell books to is like a Buddhist who likes cats. I mean, aside from the fact that I like this book and I think it's cat comics sell well. Right. I think it's cute. And there was some joke about like getting wrinkly while ironing. Do you see the irony? Anyway, that I'm like, okay, you got your cats, you got your puns. I am totally in with this book. But yes, then I went and I sold it to Kenshi up at Arcane Comics and he's like, oh man, I'm going to have to get one of these for my mom. so, well, I have a like good understanding of which shops sell what kinds of things. Sometimes it's actually informed by, I'm like, well, I know that, you know, the zine guy at Elliott Bay Books is going to eat this up. He's going to want like 20 copies. Let's go. Which is nice because I feel like I'm agonizing a little bit less over my submissions queue, which at the beginning I was going through incredibly slowly because I wasn't sure what my catalog was going to be. So I was kind of, you know, for someone who doesn't super love making really fast decisions or talking on the phone, I certainly like made up this job for myself where I have to make a lot of fast decisions and talk on the phone. Hey, but I'm getting a lot more decisive, and it's easier to tell now that I have some numbers and history and a catalog to tell. Oh, this is going to sell well. This is going to be okay. You know, Larry Reed at Fantagraphics Bookstore is going to love this one. Oh, or Larry Reed at Fantagraphics Bookstore is going to say this is too mainstream, but I know I can sell it to a bunch of other comic shops. That sort of thing.
Oh, dope. So you said before that some shops come to you without even seeing your catalog and saying, hey, let's do business. How has the marketing arm of Emerald Comics been working for you in the past 6 months?
The marketing arm is kind of funny, as it's mostly me, and occasionally I hire a friend to help me do some Twitter. But a lot of it is this very passive, like I'm taking pictures of the books that I'm selling to people and putting those pictures on Instagram and tagging the people whose books I'm selling and the store I'm selling them to. So it's not like a big, well thought out marketing plan. On the other hand, the shop owners talk, and I think in terms of being a person who's bringing in interesting content and maybe making some shop owners' lives a little bit easier, especially for the consignment folks who are, you know, going from 80 different accounts down to now a mere like 60 different accounts because I've taken on a bunch of people. They all know me and they, you know what I do. And even exploring some new shops in Portland, I have yet to go into a shop and say Emerald Comics Distro and have people not know what I'm talking about, which is cool. Admittedly, this is like super regional, right? So I'm sure if I, go to a comic shop in Omaha, Nebraska, unless Kayla Swain and Joanna Wong have been talking me up, they're not going to have any idea. But you never know that the big burst of like weird publicity that I got in March has, I have coasted fairly far on that in terms of name recognition. And I also kind of wonder, I kind of wonder if I occasionally get name recognition more from a like, oh, I think I saw that on Facebook 6 months ago. I don't know. As opposed to people actually knowing who I am and what I'm doing. And that's fine with me because I will happily like ride on my own pretend coattails. But I got an email from a shop in Salem who had heard about what I was doing in Portland and was like, hey, I'm not too much further south and I could do a pickup in Portland. Let's talk. And some folks have sought me out through social media, but yeah, I could do a lot more with implementing marketing things than I currently do. I think I've been keeping it at a level that's appropriate for the amount of like infrastructure I currently have. When I start, being able to do mail orders and, support a catalog of, 200 items instead of 120 items, then yeah, I will step up marketing things to try to get the word out a little bit more. But I don't know. I think the Instagram thing has been pretty great because it's satisfying for creators to get a notification and be like, oh, look, my book's in the shop. Yay.
I feel like we're kinder spirits in the podcast world just because a lot of what you were saying, I don't know if you're feeling this, Wilson, we could relate to from people we've had on a cast standpoint. I remember like the first time we had to say no to somebody and that was rough for me. And then the recognition we get through the grapevine from other creators as opposed to our initial reaching out to every single person we had on and then finding our voice. So yeah, it's really cool to hear you say that. And then I don't know, I guess I wasn't expecting to be able to relate to that so closely.
Yeah, likewise. It's very eerie in that aspect where we have reached out to people who have then said, oh yeah, we know you because you interviewed X person. Uh-huh. And me and that person, we did a book together, or we secured an interview with Joe Illich, of Lionforge, because we did an interview with N. Stephen Harris, who worked with him on a different book. So So it's very interesting for us. Like Lou said, I'm a bit amazed that we can resonate with your marketing, your passive marketing. Yep. Still being a bit of a business success for you.
Yeah. I mean, my shops talk, my creators talk, shops recommend creators to me. If they're coming in, selling minis, say, oh, also have you heard about, Anne and what she does? I've have some lovely support from my creators. Lucy Bellwood has good things to say to me about me, and she does a lot of content that is about kind of the business side of comics, and as balanced with like how to be a sane person and also make art and also make money. She has some really cool content out there that's about balancing like the creative aspect of making stuff with the, okay, now what aspect of being a creative professional. And she holds, I would say, pretty good sway in the indie comics universe. So it's been wonderful having her occasionally talk me up and in general be a big support. I get kind words from, for example, the editors of Tabula Edom, which is a queer tarot comic anthology. Again, niche, but it does quite well in the Northwest. And I have also, you know, really, I get a lot of kind words from my creators, which is the best litmus test for me that I'm, you know, doing a good job. But also I know that they are likely to recommend my services to people who are trying to do the thing that they're doing. So that's useful for passive marketing as well.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that I feel like y'all are underappreciated in the podcast world because you do get really rad people, especially on your interview segments. And I don't know how to, within the podcast universe, how you approach marketing, but I'm a fan of both the depth of the conversation that y'all do and the like high quality rad people that you get on your podcast. I'm really excited to listen to that Lion Forge podcast a little bit later.
Oh, sweet. We appreciate that. Yeah, the conversation with Joe was, the word that I used was illuminating.
Nice.
He has so much wisdom and knowledge and, you know, it's just, yeah, about the industry.
Yeah.
Yeah, the word I used is polished because Joe just... You can tell he's been there and he's prepared.
Yeah, you did use polished. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, he's mm-hmm. Yeah, is very polished and very just boom. Yeah. So now, next question that I have, one of my last ones, is when it comes to your all ages books, since, you know, the holiday season is right around the corner, what are the ones that you guess, you know, for podcast listeners, they should probably check out and pick up for, you know, anyone that they're still trying to figure out presents for?
One that is probably more widely available because it was nominated for an Eisner that I think is just beautiful art is called Ricky. It's out on Karate Pet Shop Press. It's Norm Harper and Matthew Foltz Gray does the art, and it's a retelling of Ricky Tikki Tavi. But it's a beautiful, beautiful book with really, really fun art. There's a volume that speaks to my inner child that the press is out of Minnesota, so I'm not sure how available this is widely, but it's called Robo Cats versus Thunder Dogs, and it is exactly what it says on the tin. It is cats and dogs in mechs fighting. Total love letter to Transformers. It is short. It is a complete story. It is super adorable.
I'm totally googling that.
Yeah, no, it's great.
Robo Cats versus Thunder Dogs.
I'll make sure to send you links to these things. It's interesting. Every comic shop has its own flavor. And I find I don't necessarily like... They're all my children. I don't have favorites. like, I see what each one of them is doing. That being said, I do think that in order to survive, a comic shop has to kind of have a secondary purpose. By that, I mean, like, it needs to either be some flavor of community gathering space that, you know, has tables for games or, you know, comfy seating to hang out and shoot the shit about comics, or have some other thing other than just comics that they're selling, like, you know, clothing or games or some other thing. And I'm saying this because don't know if y'all heard, but Xanadu, the long-standing Seattle comic shop downtown, is closing. And I'm sad to hear that. Obviously, I got my little sadness box of consignment stuff back from them. They're shutting their doors at the end of January. They've been open for like 40 years and they've been having a hard time. I mean, everybody's having a hard time. I, you know, hear buzz from shop owners, and it's not an easy time to have a comic shop right now. And a lot of comic shops in the Seattle area or, you know, Pacific Northwest have been doing some interesting things to kind of survive it's hard to have a comic shop. There are a few more, you know, traditional ones that don't necessarily have a big web presence and, maybe have some gaming tables, but don't necessarily, you know, they haven't also turned into a coffee shop or anything, that are surviving pretty well. But I honestly, I wish them all the best, and I hope that we don't lose any more than Xanadu. And that's part of the reason why I've kept Emerald's focus on wholesale so much, is because I do want people to go support their local comic shop. Mm-hmm. My hope is that comic shops can in turn support their people in terms of fostering community.
Yeah, I think you hit on something super important, because Wilson and I have talked about how my least favorite comic shop owners are the ones who expect the industry to guide their business, mm-hmm. and have done nothing over the course of the last 30 years to create a community or to try to attract new people in their shop, and then get sort of mad when their sales start going down.
Yeah, I mean, comics are changing, and you either change with them or you fight the tide until you're exhausted.
Yeah. What's the quote? Adapt or die, or evolve or die?
Yeah.
Evolve or die?
Yeah.
Either way, it's one of those things.
And there's definitely shops and comics creators and all that are adapting, so we'll see what the future brings.
Sweet. So, Lou, any final questions on your part before I come in with my final question?
You go ahead. I'll think. Because once you said final question, my mind shifted to the how are you in fiction thing. So when my mind shifted gears, I'm having trouble shifting back. So you go ahead and ask, and I'll see.
I can switch back. All right, yeah, no problem, man. So last question that I had regarding distribution and everything is, you were saying earlier, excuse me, you were saying earlier that a lot of things that you are selling are still niche. Have you been seeing a lot of overlap between the niche pieces, you know, where it's like, oh, like, you know, these people like this niche, but they also really like this niche. So I've been able to, I guess, like get double or triple points.
That's a good question. I think I'm going to have to be in shops for another 6 months before I can really answer that. But okay. there's definitely overlap. It's like the creator of Chuck the Monk said when I met him and we were chatting about his book, he's like, I realize I have two different audiences. I have the Buddhism audience and I have the cat audience, and sometimes they overlap and sometimes they don't. It's interesting to me to see where, like, if I'm going to make broad sweeping generalizations about indie comics, there's the people who are trying to be mainstream comics but didn't get into Diamond or don't want to, you know, print thousands of copies for some other reason. And then there's the people who, like, are more aligned with the zine crowd, who are doing Black and White Autobio. And if you, you know, want to throw gross generalizations about Seattle, it's, you know, the beardy flannel guys who are writing Black and White Autobio. I say this being friends with many, many beardy flannel guys who make many, many comics. And in fact, carrying comics from two lovely beardy flannel guys, Mark Allender and Brandon Lehman, who I have accidentally mixed up before because they look kind of similar. And one of their comics is The Wizard and the other one is Kill the Wizard. Both very good black and white fantasy comics. But it's interesting.
That's all valid for the mix-up. It's kind of like, hey, could you blame me?
All that being said, it's interesting to me to see where the sort of trying to be more mainstream and trying to be more indie people overlap or don't. I think there's a place in the world of indie comics for both of those flavors of folks. I don't think that they're necessarily always separate. I would say presses like Rosarium Press is appealing to both, which I think is really cool. Rosarium has a pretty eclectic collection of comics that they do. The ones I carry from them are one all-ages title and then three speculative fiction titles. And I've you know, been reading over some of their forthcoming stuff, and they've got an autobiographical title coming up. So they have a lot of they are, and even in their specfic stuff, they've got folks who have really cool, more geared towards indie, I guess, if art styles, like Keith Cross does the book Day Black.
Oh, I have
one of Day Black. Volume 2 is coming soon. And, you know, his style is informed by tattoo and very, like, he makes a really cool use of black and white medium. So that's all very, like, indie comics. But at the same time, it's, like, it's a vampire story, and that's a little bit more mainstream comics. Also, it's, like, a glossy trade, which fits in with the, you know, I can sell that to bookstores easily type of product. So I think that a lot of the indie comics people like to kind of ignore that the web comics people or some of the people who are making glossier trades exist. And I don't know if the web comics people are paying any attention to the like indie look at my cool Rise of Graph zine people. But I don't know. I've always been a person who likes to squish things together and see what happens. So here I am squishing fairly capital I indie stuff with people who are independently making stuff that might, you know, be more mainstream were it picked up by a mainstream publisher. We'll see what happens. I'm curious to see where my sales are at in another 6 months.
So yeah, me too. I'm definitely intrigued to see how that works out in the next 6 months.
Okay. So my last question is, now that you're on the ground and running, how has doing all of this affected you as a creative in terms of your writing work and your graphic design work?
In terms of like, I'm still doing my freelance gigs that I do partially because Emerald does not in fact pay the bills, but partially because, you know, that's an established practice that's going. That, however, is not my personal creative practice. And I'm not going to lie, my personal creative practice has taken a major hit the past 6 months. And I'm pretty at peace with it because I know that goes with the territory of starting a business, running a business for the first chunk of time. I, at some point, was looking at my little notebook. I do all of my creative stuff in a single notebook. I usually go through about 4 a year. And I'm like sort of halfway through my third one. And I was like, oh man, bemoaning to one of my marketing group friends. And she was like, you did start a business. Like, oh yeah. Right. That took a little bit of my time and energy. So my goal for 2018 is to seek out more of that balance and reconcile the, now that I sort of have a routine under my belt, the what I'm doing with Emerald and, you know, my freelance, the rest of my freelance portfolio, and then what I'm doing with my own creative process, because I put out like a heck ton of comics in 2016 and put out nothing in 2017. So if I could get a like happy medium between those two things for 2018, that would be great.
So my last thing, actually, before we hit this power of you and fiction question that Alu has, is what advice would you give any budding entrepreneurs for like whatever their business is?
Sure. I would say if the idea of cost benefit analysis doesn't make sense to you or seems scary, figure out what it is and do it. It's okay to ask for help, and doing a lot of that is really helpful. Part of the reason why I have been successful is because I have had conversations with other business owners and gotten some sort of light mentorship from folks who know what they're doing. I'd also remind people who are starting out that it is totally possible to hire people to teach you stuff or hire people on a limited term, like help me get X set up or help me get a reasonable plan for my social media marketing. Somebody who knows how to do that, you don't have to reinvent the wheel. Somebody who knows how to do that can like get you started for 2 hours worth of independent contractor pay. And that's super useful. And I guess also just boundaries. I feel like every step of my freelancing and now entrepreneurial career has been about figuring out what my boundaries are. And I mean that both in terms of like when you're in charge of all of your time, it's like leaving home for the first time and you don't necessarily have a parent who's telling you how to spend your time. Suddenly you're like, wow, I'm in charge of all this time. What am I going to do? Is it going to be video games for 12 hours? Maybe. that was somewhat of my experience. I quit my day job about halfway through grad school after I had been freelancing full-time or part-time for a while and along with my day job. So day job, freelance and day job, and then quit. And I was doing grad school through all of that, which was a little bit manic. So I feel like I had a layer of brand new boundaries and figuring out how to make my life workable after I quit my day job, and a fresh new layer after I was done with grad school, because then I didn't have that structure to like organize my life and time. And now that I've, you know, started Emerald, it's a whole huge pile of new responsibilities, and figuring out how to balance all of that is ongoing. But I don't think I've been entirely unsuccessful. I think I've been doing okay, actually.
Wait, good deal. All right, Lou, you want to hit us with the power of you in fiction question?
Okay, so another thing we're going to do during this season three that you might enjoy, and is Wilson and I are taking our segments to a more topical route. So we're putting together these more curated episodes on these broader ideas, and one of the ones we're doing is called The Power of You in Fiction, which focuses on how fictional characters have an effect on your life, and focuses on the first time people saw a fictional character that reminded them of themselves in some way and evoked thoughts, feelings, inspiration, emotions. So the question is, when is the first time you saw yourself in a work of fiction in any medium, and what type of effect did that have on you as a person?
That's a great question. I know that as a white woman, I get a lot of media representation. Do I connect with that media representation? Sometimes yes, a lot of times no. And I feel like the places I've seen myself, I don't necessarily see a character and go like, oh yeah, that's definitely me. But there are aspects of my existence that I feel like some media has really captured, and places where I feel seen, whether or not necessarily anyone feels like an analog for me. For example, like, so I grew growing up and finding comics was weird because I grew up in a small town, mountains of Colorado. Actually, the town that South Park is based off of. So in some ways, I definitely see my experience of growing up in small town Colorado, like accurately reflected in South Park once you get behind the hyperbole. So that's one place, whether or not I want it, that I see myself in media. But I got comics online, and then I got comics from the library because it was like probably 45 minutes to the nearest comic shop driving. And some of the first, I just started out like checking out whatever random trade paperbacks were there. And, you know, eventually I started ordering stuff. But at first I was just like, okay, we're getting whatever the library has. And one of those books was A Distant Soil by Colleen Duran, which was put out by currently it's put out by Image Shadowline. I guess it probably was at the time too. And it's this science fiction story that involves a lot of aliens and power plays and teens that are like swept up into this bizarro fantasy alien world. It feels very like the, and her style is kind of fashion advertising from 1989. So it feels like the demon prom out of Labyrinth, but like, if it were sci-fi. And it also has some queer representation that's like it's not a gay comic, but it had this like background queer representation that as an adult I realized was like, oh, okay, that actually was my, you know, queer awakening comic. Because in some ways I felt really seen or really drawn to this comic in ways I couldn't even necessarily articulate at the time, because like many people, I didn't figure out my own queerness until like my mid-20s. That happens when you grow up in a small town in a culture that's incredibly heteronormative. Ta-da! So that was one that stuck with me a lot for reasons I couldn't articulate until much later in my life. I definitely went through the like phase that I know a lot of girls go through of like gentle misogyny in like, you know, middle and high school, where I'm like, oh yes, I am not like the other girls, not thinking like, okay, what's wrong with the other girls. And I understand like why I went through that phase and have, you know, made peace with everything since then, but I still really love books like Tamora Pierce's Song of the Lioness Quartet, which is, you know, about the girl that dresses up like a boy to go to night school at K night school, not in night school, and, you know, becomes a lady knight and eventually does get to come out and be obviously female and be a knight in this culture where she is the first one to do that. And like, I loved that. As a kid, I still love it, but it definitely spoke to whatever flavor of tomboyishness or general irritation with my expected social roles that I had at the time. So that's another one that stuck with me for a long time, just because I did feel like those characters were kind of me.
So once you realized you were seen in these fictional pieces, what has that realization done for you now as a creative?
Well, again, I'm going to go back to this piece of kind of realizing my own queerness, partially through thinking about my relationship with media, because that has echoed back through some of what I'm creating. I am working on a novel, which has been tragically backburned this year, but, you know, that part where I started a business, that is kind of the novel that I wish I had when I was growing up. So it's a, you know, like Tamora Pierce, it's kind of a big, rollicking, epic fantasy thing, but it's actually a novel-length retelling of a Romanian fairy tale that has some really fascinating, canonically queer content in it. There's like fountains that switch people's genders and interesting stuff like that. But it's a fantasy novel. It has great, powerful female characters. It also has quite a few layers of queerness to it. So that's, I know that on a level I am writing the book that I wish I'd had as a teenager, that I didn't quite had, but I, you know, had pieces of in different works.
Sweet, sweet, sweet. So, and it was a thrill, as always, to have you on. And now before we sign off, I just want you to take the moment to give listeners your social media, website, anything like that. So if there are any creators out there that want to link with you, or any comic book shop owners that want to link with you, they know where to find you.
Yeah. Again, I am emeraldcomicsdistro.com is my website. You can find me on Twitter at emeralddistro, and you can find me on Instagram at emeraldcomicsdistro. Instagram is a great place to see what I'm doing more or less up to the moment. And if you have general questions or want to know what I'm about, definitely check out my website at emeraldcomicsdistro.com. There's also a portal to submit work if you're interested in that.
Wonderful. So, Anne, thanks again for coming on. We look forward to chatting with you in the future.
Thank you, Wilson, and thank you, Lou.
All right. So, podcast listeners out there, we hope that you've enjoyed this episode of our What's Up Wednesday, and we hope that we have accomplished our mission of always bringing you a higher class of comic book analysis. And on my side is RP Wilson with my phenomenal co-host,
Lucius Illuminix.
And in the words of the illustrious Wazalu Muhammad Jaco, peace and much love to you.